from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Carl Zimmer is the author of 10 books about science, including Microcosm, Parasite Rex, and Soul Made Flesh, which was named one of the top 100 books of the year by the New York Times Book Review. His science essays appear regularly in the New York Times, the Scientific American, Time, and Discover. His latest book has a scientific focus too, but with a twist. It's a book about science and tattoos. It's called Science Inc., with a K, Tattoos for the Science Obsessed. We'll talk with Carl Zimmer about his new book and much more after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Carl Zimmer is a science writer who can make even microbes sound interesting. Same actually is true for E. coli and what he calls ecosystems of the gut. Zimmer writes about science for the New York Times, Scientific American, Time, Discover, and others. He's published 10 books that cover everything from evolution to neuroscience. But his latest book explores two topics that don't typically wind up in the same sentence: science and tattoos. It's called Science Inc. That's Inc. with a K. Tattoos of the Science Obsessed. Inside are the stories and photos of scientists whose tattoos include solar systems and seismographs, DNA and dinosaurs. Zimmer writes about the passion and promise those tattoos represent, even a tattoo by the way of LSD, which it turns out began as a speck of fungi and still may offer promise to heal the brain. Carl Zimmer's previous books include A Planet of Viruses, Brain Cuttings, and Parasite Rex. And he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. I should also mention that you're going to be appearing later today at Byers Auditorium at Genentech, UCSF Mission Bay campus at 12:30 for a topic we'll get into at some point, the hidden world of microbes. And then later tonight, you're going to be at the Black and Blue Tattoo. I'm positive the only time in the history of this program where we've had someone go from UCSF to Black and Blue Tattoo in the same evening.
It's a shorter distance than people realize, I think.
Well, let's talk about that. It's because was this a surprise to you that so many notable scientists walk around with these tattoos?
Yes, this was not something that I kind of came into having any idea. I just totally stumbled into it. One day I just happened to notice that a neuroscientist I know from Harvard had a DNA tattoo on his shoulder. And I said, hey, nice tattoo. And he started to explain to me how it basically stood for his wife's initials and genetic code. And I said, well, that's very geeky of you, but it's interesting. And so I have a blog, and on my blog I kind of fool around and just throw out ideas. And so I took a picture of his tattoo and I stuck it up there. And I said, anybody else have tattoos out there? Any other scientists with your science hidden under your lab coats? And I immediately got deluged with pictures, and I still get them now. It's been about 4 years, and I get a couple every week, and they're all over the board, and they're amazing.
And what did you make of that? I mean, what did it reveal to you?
It revealed this hidden side to these scientists, many of which I'd actually met. You know, I mean, I knew these people by name. I mean, I meet a lot of scientists. I spend a lot of time with them. I talk to them. I interview them. We have a drink together. And then, you know, a few months later, they say, hey, by the way, here's this, you know, gigantic sea lily across my back. Who knew? But the more I got into it, the more intrigued I became because, first of all, I think it actually said a lot about, as you say, the passion of scientists. And also, just by writing about their tattoos, you end up writing about every branch of science, and you start discovering all these amazing stories and the kinds of things that actually motivate a scientist to dedicate his or her entire life to some particular subject.
So did you wind up in the end feeling like it's not such an odd juxtaposition, science and tattoos, that it actually makes sense?
Yeah, I really believe it does make sense. I mean, I think that it's just an outward manifestation of something that's deep inside of all scientists.
One of the early tattoos in the story, part of what I enjoyed about it is that you learn things. I mean, so let's just start with one, a phrase everyone hears and knows, Occam's razor. Remind us of what that is. This individual had it actually inscribed in Latin, which was a phrase I had to read a couple of times, I have to say, to sort of get what I understood Occam's razor to mean.
Right. So, and I happen to have the page open right here. I haven't memorized it, I'll confess. It's numquam ponenda est pluralitas sin necessitate, which, if you translate it roughly, means plurality should never be posited without necessity. So William of Ockham is believed to be a 13th century monk who is a philosopher as well, and basically was trying to establish a principle, sort of a general principle of philosophy and of religion and all sorts of things. But it's really best known now as Occam's razor in science. And so actually this is a it's on the body of someone named Jimmy Wu, who was getting his PhD in molecular pharmacology. It applies there. It applies in math. It applies everywhere. Basically, in science, you look for the simplest explanation you can, the most elegant explanation there is. It may not necessarily be right, but it's the best place to start. And, you know, people like Einstein have sort of paraphrased the idea that, I mean, basically you want to look for the simplest solution, but not too simple. And so, you know, it's a beautiful concept, and it's the kind of thing that is very much at the heart of what scientists do. So I'm not surprised that someone had it tattooed across his side.
Read it again and the translation, because it's lovely in its own way, even though it's not quite as simple as keep it simple.
Numquam ponenda est pluralitas sine necessitate. I don't speak Latin, so I'm butchering it, I'm sure. But roughly translated, plurality should never be posited without necessity.
Hmm. Is there a connection then between that one of the other famous, you know, simple phrases that is someone else's tattoo is E equals MC squared? Is that another part of what's interesting about this to you, that it is in those sort of how much a few simple words, or in this case, a few simple letters can convey?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that when you do distill down some aspect of the natural world to a simple principle or a simple equation, it's something you can fit on your arm. That does speak to the power of science to really get down to the heart of things. That doesn't mean that the world is simple. That doesn't mean that scientists are trying to deny the beautiful complexity of the world. But it's amazing that actually you can explain a lot of it with something like E equals MC squared or the theory of natural selection. You can actually get down to these principles that, like I say, are short enough to stick on your arm.
You wrote an article recently about the difficulty of correcting mistakes in science, that it takes a lot of time to replicate experiments. And so sometimes even if something's wrong, it takes a long time to get that corrected. And I was thinking about that with tattoos because, I mean, isn't there something sort of problematic about that? If you're a scientist and you have a tattoo and it turns out to be wrong and yet you can't change it.
Right. I when I go to the tattoo parlor tonight, I'm going to ask them about what some of these scientists are going to have to do to revise their tattoos. I don't know what the technology of that is, but I'll give you one case. So, for example, there are dinosaurs that scientists now recognize are the ancestors of birds. And we can recognize them if we've seen Jurassic Park, things like Velociraptor and Tyrannosaurus Rex were actually close relatives of birds. And, you know, the paleontologists, you know, figure that out based mainly on skeletal parts, you know, that their skeletons were very, very similar to those of living birds. And so I actually have a lovely tattoo in this book of a species called Deinonychus, and it's a lovely thing, but it's got a kind of reptilian scaly skin. And the little problem is that, say, in the past decade or so, these paleontologists have found fossils of these very dinosaurs with feathers on them, which means that actually feathers evolved tens of millions of years before people realized in the dinosaur lineage. So, you know, even T-Rex might have had some feathers. And so this guy is going to, I'm afraid that he's going to have to go back in and get re-inked because he's going to have to cover his dinosaur with feathers. And that's probably going to be painful.
Carl Zimmer, our guest, his new book, Science Inc., Tattoos of the Science Obsessed. You can find a link to a collection of photos and some of these science tattoos at our website, kqed.org/forum. Again, he'll be over at Genentech Hall in Byers Auditorium at UCSF Mission Bay Campus today at 12:30 for a different sort of topic. It's called Gut Check, the Hidden World of Microbes. He'll make it back to tattoos later today at Black and Blue Tattoo in San Francisco. After that, Booksmith on Haight Street, where they're doing what? They're doing a sort of book swap, science swap, not tattoos.
Well, we'll see. But the event, they do have a regular book swap event. And as part of the Bay Area Science Festival, they're going to have a science theme tonight.
Got a web comment from Andy who writes in, I have a tattoo based on the paths of subatomic particles that result from collisions and particle accelerators. I was inspired by the beauty of the convoluted curls described as particles pull into ever tighter circles. Are those the sort of comments contributions that you get? There you go.
Well, yeah, well, I'm just opening to a page of a tattoo that's very similar to that. So the commenter has company. Yeah, yes, I mean there is this beauty to particle physics when you smash a couple particles together, you get these showers of even tinier particles that exist for just a tiny fraction of a second. And again, I think that's an iconic image because it shows our ability to go beyond what we can just see, to get down into the very core of nature itself.
And if you want to join in our conversation today, or you want to contribute an idea about the kind of tattoo you either have or would like to have, you can post it on our Facebook page as well as our website. You can email your thoughts to us. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Do you have a scientific tattoo? We'd like to hear what it is at 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Facebook page or our website options as well. One of my I want to ask you about a couple of favorites that I had because of the story that was behind them. And one of them was LSD, which, as I mentioned in the introduction, began, I guess, as a speck from a fungi of rye, right? Tell us that story about sort of the history of LSD. And about sort of the intriguing promise that it still has, which actually takes us back to the origins of the original research about it.
Yeah. There was this chemist named Albert Hofmann, he, like many people in the 1940s, was looking at the kinds of chemicals that microbes make, including fungi. And so there are all these molecules that these microbes are spitting out, and chemists are playing around with them, and they're wondering if something's interesting. And so then one morning he synthesized something called, the long name was the 25th analog in a series of diethylamide derivatives of lysergic acid, which we know as LSD. He just synthesized it one morning, just another day at work. And then he started to feel kind of bad and he decided he needed to take the day off. He didn't quite know what was happening. And his descriptions of what it was like are just amazing. You think about it, I mean, this is the first person who on an LSD trip, and he didn't even like take it. He was just sort of absorbing it. And he said the way he described it was he felt like someone had put a giant kaleidoscope in front of his eyes, and he just was just lying there in bed saying, "What is going on?" So he went back in and he tried to the lab after he recovered the next day and said, "Okay, let me try to create a dose of this to see what effect it would have on me." So he actually took it. It turned out to be a huge dose. I mean, and he had another crazy night. He wrote up a report about it. His bosses couldn't believe it. LSD did go on to have this amazing cultural existence. And, you know, it's illegal now, but today, you know, neuroscientists are actually using it in experiments to try to understand, well, how is this having such an effect on our brains, and what does it tell us about our brains? And so it's actually becoming a scientific tool again.
And there's a tattoo of it as well.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So there's someone here has a tattoo of it, and it's it's a pretty handsome molecule, I think.
One of the other stories that intrigued me was the story of the P53 gene and the role that it plays. Would you tell that story also? Again, a tattoo that someone has, but just so interesting to me, something I'd never heard of, and the kind of potential significance that it has.
Yeah, so there were a number of tattoos of DNA out there, and some of them are just sort of all-purpose DNA, sort of the icon of the double helix. But scientists being scientists, some of them would actually have particular segments of DNA with colors representing the different bases, in the sense the genetic letters in DNA. And one of them had the gene, part of a gene called P53. So P53 is considered, think of it as a gatekeeper of the cell. So when cells are growing and dividing and they're copying their DNA, P53, basically the protein made by this gene, kind of oversees the process. And if everything's good, if everything's going regularly and at a good pace, nothing happens. But if that cell starts to get a bit out of control, starts to divide too fast, P53 will actually force the cell to commit suicide. And that's one of our most powerful anti-cancer mechanisms in our body. We're developing cancer all the time, every day, and P53 is there to keep us from getting it. If you were to knock P53 out and the related genes like it, you would immediately develop cancer. The irony is that this cure is pretty harsh. You're killing cells to stop the cancer, and it creates a lot of damage on a very microscopic level, obviously. But over years, it actually starts to damages our tissues. So as we cure ourselves of cancer, we're damaging our tissues, which actually later in life raises our odds of getting cancer. So we're just pushing off the inevitable.
Carl Zimmer, again, the new book, Science Inc., Tattoos of the Science Obsessed. I wanted to ask you a question as well about what you're going to be talking about in just 2 hours from now over at UCSF, and that's the hidden world of microbes. Are there any microbe tattoos? I can't recall in the book.
We've got lots of microbe tattoos.
So I'm just going to read a little bit of this story that you wrote a year ago, actually, in the New York Times, because it takes us into this story, and I think in such an interesting way. And so I'm just going to read the first paragraph. Dr. Alexander Kurutz, is that the right pronunciation? Dr. Alexander Kurutz had run out of options. A gastroenterologist at the University of Minnesota, he took on a patient suffering from a vicious gut infection. She was crippled by constant diarrhea. Dr. Kurutz treated her with an assortment of antibiotics, but nothing seemed to stop the bacteria. The patient was wasting away, losing 60 pounds over the course of 8 months. She was dwindling down the drain, and she probably would have died. He decided his patient needed a transplant, but he didn't give her a piece of someone else's intestine or a stomach or any other organ. Instead, he gave her some of her husband's bacteria. Pick up the story from what that meant and what took place.
Well, the procedure he performed is sometimes called a fecal transplant, and I hope everyone's done with breakfast before I dive in here. But, basically, your gut is full of trillions of bacteria, and you actually depend on some of them very much. And part of what they do for you is they keep out pathogens. So this pathogen that this woman was suffering from was called C. difficile, really nasty bacteria, very resistant to antibiotics these days, and can often be fatal. And it had just taken over her gut. So what they did was they diluted a stool sample from her husband, who was perfectly healthy, and put it in her intestines, literally in a matter of days, she turned around. She had a solid bowel movement, and then later they actually did a survey of the microbes in her gut, Basically, what you do is you go in and you grab bits of DNA and figure out what species are there. The C. difficile was gone. What was also interesting was, you know, while she had a C. difficile infection, she had all sorts of weird species in her gut that you would never find in there normally. All sorts of strange things were showing up there because it was so disrupted. And many of the normal species were missing. And when they checked a couple weeks after the procedure, her husband's ecosystem had taken over her gut, She never had trouble with it again.
So beyond, obviously, the extraordinary significance of what this meant for this one patient, what has it opened our eyes to about the significance of microbes and the role that they can play in health and in medicine?
Well, you know, this is something I'm going to want to explore with the scientists from UCSF I'm going to talk to this afternoon. But, I mean, I think one of the things that it shows is that you have to take a kind of ecological approach to medicine. You can't just go into a situation with guns blazing. You know, if you just say, okay, let's just kill all the bacteria, you're going to be killing some of the bacteria that we all depend on. And so, you know, scientists barely understand the rules of these ecosystems, what makes them work. You know, maybe there were just a couple species that they could have given this woman, and those two species would have taken care of everything. You know, we have hundreds, maybe thousands of species in our gut. We don't quite know which ones are doing what. And we need to find out.
Does this tie into something you've written about as well, about how so many times now we're finding out that we don't have antibiotics that will work, that germs have figured out a way to resist those? Is part of this possibly a solution to that problem?
It's possible. I mean, I certainly don't think that antibiotics are going to go away, you know, unless, of course, you know, the resistance keeps getting worse. I mean, again and again, we're discovering bacteria that are resistant to all but the nastiest antibiotics out there. The problem keeps getting worse, and so it's important to explore these alternatives. And one of them is like figuring out how to maintain the ecosystem of your gut. And it could be, maybe it could be with some, you know, special new kind of yogurt. We don't know.
And part of why this is significant, it ties into things you've written about evolution, that as germs continue to evolve, not only do they become more drug resistant, they spread. You've written about a bacteria in New York hospitals that's now wind up in 30-some states.
Yeah, that's right. I wrote an article for the Times over the summer about the evolution of New York City. And so I was looking at, you know, the evolution of the animals and the plants there. But the microbes are evolving, too. And there was a strain of bacteria there that suddenly became really nasty. And then it evolved this resistance. And then it spread to these states and actually spread to other countries. And we can trace it all to Brooklyn. And the really cunning thing that bacteria can do is, you know, once they've evolved these resistance genes, those genes actually can move from one species to another. They actually swap genes. If bacteria die, other bacteria can actually swallow up their genes and make them part of their genome. And so these genes are shuttling around. They're actually, you know, if you take antibiotics, if you take some Cipro or penicillin, and you get resistant bacteria inside of you, those genes might go from one species to another inside of you. So we are these little laboratories.
Carl Zimmer, our guest, writes about science for many publications, including the New York Times and Scientific American. His new book, Science Inc., Tattoos of the Science Obsessed. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about that world of microbes and something called the microbiome, but also about tattoos. And we want to hear the tattoos that you have that speak to a particular passion in science. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Go to our Facebook page or our website and add your comments there as well. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Carl Zimmer, our guest, his latest book, Science Inc., Tattoos of the Science Obsessed. His previous works include A Planet of Viruses, Parasite Rex, and Evolution, the Triumph of an Idea. He also lectures at Yale University, where he teaches writing about science and the environment. He'll be over at Byers Auditorium, Genentech Hall, on the UCSF Mission Bay campus in just a couple of hours, talking about the hidden world of microbes, something we were talking about right before the break. And then later tonight, he'll be at Black and Blue Tattoo in San Francisco talking about science and science tattoos. And we want to hear some of your stories as well. Let's start with Tierney in San Francisco. Tierney, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm actually not a scientist. I'm an artist, but I've always had a passion for science. And my tattoo is fortunately, really geeky. I'm a big fan of Devo, and I found that they had, or the story goes, that they got all of their ideas for the whole theory of de-evolution from an old propaganda book called Jocko Homo Heaven Bound. And I found an illustration in there that says, four tails our ancestors lost. And so I had that tattooed where I would have had a tail, which makes it a tramp stamp, but there you have it.
Okay, Tierney, thank you. Carl Zimmer?
That is mighty geeky, but, you know, I think geeky tattoos are a good thing. You know, we definitely have a lot of evolution-themed tattoos in the book. A lot of people really like, a lot of evolutionary biologists have Darwin's Tree of Life tattooed on them in one way or the other. Darwin wrote in a notebook just a very simple sketch of a tree of life. And I believe it was 1839 when he was very young. It was his first glimmer of this great idea he had. And right to the side of it, he wrote, I think, you know, he was getting this idea. So some people have that tattooed on them.
And there are also some really elaborate ones.
That's right.
One based on the book by Richard Dawkins, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So Richard Dawkins, the English biologist, wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker. And so there's one person who has a tattoo where Darwin is represented as the blind watchmaker. So he's got these giant black glasses on so he can't see. And out of his head springs things like DNA, and he's welding and things. It's quite a hallucination, but very cool.
I'm going to ask you to read this next comment that came in on the web because I think you'll do a much better job of pronouncing it than me. This is from Kim. Carl, go ahead.
Let's see. Wow. My husband gave me the best anniversary gift ever one year, the promise of a tattoo spelling my name in amino acids, right? Lysine, isoleucine, methionine equals Kim. Now that is romance. I have to agree. And the first tattoo that kind of set me down on this journey was a similar thing where this Harvard neuroscientist named Bob Datta, his wife's initials are EEE, and so he picked out the DNA sequence that would encode these amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, of the ones that are abbreviated E, E, and E.
Here's another tattoo with a romantic twist to it, but this is sort of the inverse. Antonio writes in, I have a tattoo with the biohazard symbol on my shoulder. When my wife learned what it meant, she prohibited me from ever touching her again.
We all make sacrifices.
Kyle writes in, my initials are KPB, and I have the three elements of the periodic table as they appear in the periodic table that compromise my initials on my forearm. The elements are potassium, phosphorus, and boron. So there's a lot of geeky stuff that goes on in this. Let's hear next from Chris in Oakland. Chris, go ahead. What's your tattoo?
Hi there. It might not be scientific, but it's zoological. You always hear about the classic undersea battle between giant squid and sperm whales, and I know that there's been some discoveries recently that go towards proving it, although for some reason it seems to be mythical, but I have a giant squid sperm whale underwater battle on my arm.
All right, Chris, thank you.
Oh, well, and that's, as far as I know, that's entirely true. That I mean, I believe they've actually found, like, giant sucker marks on sperm whales. I mean, so you know, you have these huge, colossal, literally colossal squid and sperm whale, these giants of the deep that fight it out. There actually is a squid tattoo in the book. A scientist had a squid, basically squid anatomy, put on her foot with all the little parts to it, because squid have totally bizarre anatomy, and basically their esophagus goes through the middle of their brain. I mean, it's just, they're so strange.
Chris, thanks for the call. Chris brought up sperm whale. So speaking of sperm, a forced segue if there ever was one, there's a sperm tattoo within the book as well.
That's right. That's right. And it's actually from a biologist at Syracuse University named Scott Pitnick. He studies the biology and the evolution of sperm today with, you know, real microscopes and things like that, and with a deep understanding of what sperm actually are. But he is really he wanted to pay homage to sort of the history of the discovery of sperm. And there's a classic picture from the 1600s. When people first discovered these sperm, they assumed that there must be a tiny person folded up inside of the sperm head. And so they would literally draw it with the little person all tucked in there, you know, the knees up to the chest and the arms around the knees. And because they assumed that each person was preformed in the sperm. And so he's got this gigantic preformed sperm sort of coiling around his arm. And I should point out he also has tenure.
I wonder if that's ever come up. You know, it's sort of, instead of publish or perish, this gives new meaning to those possibilities.
I think one reason that I hadn't seen tattoos before now is because people were keeping very buttoned up. I mean, I knew about one person who had a tattoo and asked him, "Would you be willing to share it with us on the blog?" And he said, he did literally say, like, "I'm going to wait till I have tenure before I do that."
Mark writes in, "Always having been fascinated by astronomy, I have the phases of the moon tattooed on my forearm, planning on getting Drake's equation done at some point as well." Drake's equation?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I haven't seen Drake's equation yet. Drake's equation is basically an equation for calculating the likelihood of life on other planets. So, you know, basically you take all the possible variables, you know, the number of stars in number of galaxies in the universe, and the number of stars in each galaxy, the number of stars that might be able to have planets around them that support life, and you go on down the line, and then you come up with a number, if the number's one, that means there's definitely life on other planets. If it's zero, there is none. I wouldn't say they've solved Drake's equation, but it's really an influential one in the search for life on other planets. Mark, I look forward to seeing that one.
Yeah, and Mark, you may want to look at Carl's book, because there's a whole chapter on astronomy. There's someone with solar system on their belly. I mean, there are lots of variations with that. Jake in Mountain View is next. Jake, go ahead.
Hey, guys. It's another non-scientist. I'm a nurse. I do work on the periphery of science. One of my adjunct duties is working with infection control at the hospital that I work for. But I picked up a tattoo that sort of sums up my personal philosophy, both when I was in the service as a combat medic and now as a nurse. And I'm just wondering if any of your other scientists or people you've interviewed have, sort of put their philosophy on their body. Mine just says, to live is to serve, and that's kind of how I treat my patients. That's how I treat my career, even when it gets a little nuts. And if you've had anybody who's done that before, I'd love to hear about it, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Jake, thanks. Nice sentiments.
Yeah. I would see that there definitely are some mottos, as it were. So we mentioned Occam's razor, for example. I mean, that is, for a lot of scientists, that's the ultimate motto. And actually, you know, what I mentioned before, how Darwin wrote, I think, next to his tree of life, in its own way, actually is kind of a motto. I've actually seen people with just those words on their arm, and it's that sort of, you know, it sort of expresses what scientists do. Like, this is my idea, and I hope that it explains the world better than previous explanations. And I might be wrong.
I interviewed Bill Langston, the neurologist and founder and director of the Parkinson's Institute down in Sunnyvale, for a film I was working on a number of years ago. And he mentioned something that's always stuck with me, is this sort of phrase that our last caller was referencing. He said, I can't remember who Bill was quoting, but the quote was, "Science takes place in the absence of prejudice and in the presence of money."
I haven't seen any tattoos to people who give grant money out, but maybe someday.
Mike in Brentwood is next. Mike, go ahead.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I wasn't calling about tattoos. I had
That's okay.
about the previous story.
Yeah.
Which, first question is, are scientists cataloging the bacteria in our gut to try to develop the understanding that the author had indicated we were lacking? That was my first question. My second question was, if you've been on a course of antibiotics, is there a recommended regimen of bacterial supplements you can take to recover from what the antibiotics do to your gut? And then one final question, I'll let you go. What's the work on new drugs to fight the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that are beginning to plague our country? Thanks. Bye-bye.
Wow.
I'm not sure I could keep pressing all of Mike's really good questions,
yeah,
which you could probably bring up in about an hour and a half before your panel. But first, on what research is being done to understand?
Yeah, those are three great questions. So the first one, the answer is, are scientists cataloging these microbes? The answer is yes. So in the United States, there's a huge project on now called the Human Microbiome Project, where hundreds of scientists are working together. Basically, they're taking samples from a large number of people, not just from the gut, but from other places, from their mouth, from their skin, all over their bodies, because we've got bacteria everywhere. And they're identifying what species they are and trying to catalog them. So that's it's going to be a colossal project. It's going to make the Human Genome Project look like a walk in the park. In terms of a regimen of bacteria that you could take to deal with after taking antibiotics, I mean, that's in theory, there should be something you could do. There's this whole world of science called probiotics. There's a lot of stuff you can buy these days that touts itself as probiotics, but there isn't really good, solid, compelling research behind them. I mean, we really don't – honestly, we're not really sure. There was just a study that came out, I believe it was last week, where scientists looked at what happens to your body when you take yogurt, which is full of bacteria. Lots of interesting things happen. You know, your own cells switch on different genes and shut certain genes off. But we don't know what that means. We don't know what that means to our health. We just don't know. So that's why this project is really important. In terms of the final question about drugs for dealing with antibiotic resistance, you know, there are people who are working on new kinds of antibiotics. So, for example, they're trying to take totally new approaches to it. So, for example, I mean, basically, like, antibiotics these days just work by essentially, like, you know, stick a wrench in it. So, you know, you stick a wrench into the process of bacteria making DNA. They can't make DNA. They die. What happens is they evolve a way to make DNA that doesn't let you get that wrench in there, in effect. So Bonnie Bassler at Princeton University has done a lot of work on how actually bacteria need to talk to each other to coordinate what they do. Part of what they do is they make you sick. So she's developing drugs that interrupt the conversation. So they can't talk to each other. So they don't even try to make you sick. It's a new way of thinking about antibiotics.
One of the things you've written again in one of your other writings, not in the tattoo book, about what is called the microbiome that I thought was really interesting. It has to do with the immune system, and that one of the things our immune system does to fight off illness is to utilize inflammation, but that too much inflammation winds up being a problem, and you need a particular microbe, right, to produce a molecule that will sort of keep inflammation at bay.
Yeah, so we have this delicate balance where, you know, inflammation is part of a very effective way that our immune system keeps us healthy. But as you say, I mean, there can be long-term damage from inflammation, and you can get kind of a runaway attack of your immune system on yourself. And actually, we need bacteria to sort of tutor us when we grow up as kids. And so if kids, the fact is that kids who get a lot of antibiotics when they're young, they tend to be more likely to get asthma and allergies.
And there's also some thought, I know, that inflammation can play a role in certain brain diseases, right? So that if you don't have a molecule that turns off that might put you at a different risk level for certain kinds of neurological disorders. Is that right?
You can have acute inflammation, which can be, incredibly dangerous. The effects of long-term inflammation, scientists are just starting to figure that out. There could be all sorts of different effects on our bodies from kind of low-level chronic inflammation. And maybe the microbiome can help us to manage that.
So there are all these possibilities with something that we're just starting to understand in terms of what microbes can do. Back to tattoos. Here's someone who writes in saying, my tattoo is a very small version of the Pioneer plaque.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one that shows where the Earth is in terms of local pulsars, a diagram of the solar system and a man and a woman. Pioneer and Voyager probes were influential in directing me into my career in engineering.
I got a number of tattoos of the Pioneer plaque, and also the
describe what that is, the Pioneer plaque.
So let's see. The Pioneer plaque it's got is a series of images that, if some other if some other civilization came across this probe, maybe they could understand something about us. I mean, and actually Pioneer and Voyager, both probes were equipped with plaques, and then one of them had actually some music on it. And so you may have seen some of the parts of it. So, for example, there's a man and a woman standing, and the man is raising his hand. There's, our commenter said, there's some geographical information, basically kind of showing where we are relative to other stars. There's some basic information about physics, there are a couple pictures of atoms that might be able to show that we actually know what atoms are. And so it's kind of the ultimate, in a sense, it's kind of the ultimate tattoo, because it's the tattoo we're sending out into space.
And this sense also of the ultimate exploration, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of invitation that here's where we are. Where are you?
Yeah, they've left the solar system, so they're on their way.
Kirsten in San Francisco writes, I have a carbon atom on one shoulder and Saturn on the other, the micro and the macro all on my own body. It's a good reminder to look beyond yourself. I love science tattoos, she says. Johnny writes in, I have a massive elbow-to-elbow tattoo of a map of the solar system. Imagine my chagrin when Pluto was declassified. Well, there you go. That's the problem.
Well, you should keep – Pluto still exists. I mean, the question is it a planet? You maybe should add a whole bunch of other little icy bodies on the edge of the solar system.
Maria writes in, my friend, a violin player and the manager of a coffee shop, has a big and beautiful and labeled amoeba over her abdomen. I'm not quite sure. I'm going to hand this over to you, Carl. Maybe you can make sense of it. As we remind everyone that Carl Zimmer will be at the UCSF Mission Bay campus this afternoon, 12:30, Genentech Auditorium, to talk about microbes. Then tonight he'll be at Black and Blue Tattoo, 7:30, to talk about tattoos. Later tonight at Booksmith Bookstore in the Haight-Ashbury, where they're going to be doing a scientific book swap. Did that make sense to you, what that last one was?
I think there might be a word missing, so I'm going to pass on that one.
Where does this take you? I mean, I'm curious about whether or not you're just going to keep getting these, whether you're going to continue, whether you're going to make this will there be an addendum to this particular book?
I don't know. That's a good question, because this has been going on for a while now, and actually people have gone to the blog and now to the book and have been getting ideas for their own tattoos, which they then email me. And so I actually have a backlog of these things. I need to start posting them on the blog, and maybe we'll do a second version of it. I don't know. I mean, the tattoos just keep coming.
Here's one that someone just sent in. It's actually a T-shirt, not a tattoo, but Drake's Equation.
Oh, there it is. Oh, fantastic. Right. So N equals R, X, F sub P, X, N, E, yes, and on and on and on. That's great. I have to get this T-shirt. I like that. I won't get the tattoo. I'll get the T-shirt.
No tattoos for you?
My philosophy, I want to follow the example of Jacques Cousteau. So Jacques Cousteau was able to be a great marine biologist without growing gills. And plus, I don't like needles.
Carl Zimmer again. He'll be at the Genentech Auditorium on the UCSF campus this afternoon at 12:30, later tonight at Black and Blue Tattoo in San Francisco. As you continue to write about science, is it inexhaustible to you? I mean, is there? Do you have a next topic in mind for a book, if not tattoos? Where will you go from here?
You know, it's funny. I started writing about science, a bit over 20 years ago now. And when I really started delving into it and really just realized that this is what I wanted to do, I was actually astonished how every time I had to write something, I was working for Discover Magazine and we had to write a few short items every month. And every time I always found more things than I could write about and a new batch of things that really excited me. And I thought, gosh, I mean, maybe we're just going to run out. I mean, they're going to find out all the neat things there are to find out, and then it's going to run out, and I'm going to be out of a job. And, you know, it's been 20 years, and it shows no sign of tapering off. In fact, it is accelerating, I feel like. So there's always going to be something new to write about. And, in fact, for me, the challenge is how do I keep from spreading myself too thin across all of it, because there's so much that's exciting out there.
You have a particular gift, I think, for summing up things neatly in a nice, concise way. An article I read of yours about what we were talking about before, the microbes and the ecosystem of the gut, and it turns out that there are only three of them, right? And you made the comparison to blood types, that there are four blood types, and the sentence, as I recall, was something like, blood type meet bug type. What do you try to, when you're teaching science writing, I'm curious about what you're trying to teach and what you think the ingredient is to that sort of clear, interesting scientific writing.
What I try to do when I'm teaching people about writing about science is to steer them away from what they're reading in scientific papers. Not that there's anything wrong with that kind of writing, but you know, adding more and more and more and more detail just so that you'll be absolutely, absolutely, absolutely right and complete and fully fleshed out, that's not going to work. That is not good writing for people who do not, you know, have a PhD in the subject you're writing about. You want to sort of step back and kind of be able to give a big picture view of things. And it could be with summing up with a few words like that. Or it could be in lots of other ways. It could be in visual ways. Last night here over in Berkeley, Radiolab, the radio show, they put on a performance on stage. And I helped them a little bit with it was all about vision and light and dark, and they wanted to talk to me about the evolution of the eye. They turned the evolution of the eye into this fantastic dance performance by the Palabolas Dance Company. And I'm sitting there in the audience saying, oh my gosh, they actually got, you know, the biology of photoreceptors right, and there's just a bunch of dancers up there waving their hands around. So there are all these different ways of crystallizing certain concepts in science, and that's where the hard work is to do that.
Carl Zimmer, our guest, he writes about science for many publications, has written many books. If you have a question for Carl about something you'd like to see him write about, or if you have a science tattoo that you haven't gotten to us yet, there's still time to do so. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Another science tattoo. My back is covered by a portrait of Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Wow. I'll have to let Neil know about that. There are a few people, it seems, who warrant living people who warrant tattoos. Stephen Hawking is another I've seen a Stephen Hawking tattoo, and
I bet there are a few Steve Jobs.
There probably are. I don't have too many really tech type tattoos in my book. I was trying to focus more on the science. So there's a whole world of tech tattoos, and I'm sure someone's going to do a book of those at some point.
I've always been a science geek, so what I decided for one of my tattoos is three atom symbols to represent my wife and two children. And back to microbes for a moment. The question is about your story of the sort of transplant from the husband to the wife to help cure the wife's intestinal problem. Did it have to be the husband, or could it be any healthy person? Which is an interesting question about these ecosystems, because they're not necessarily defined by gender or race, right?
That's right. I mean, the really fascinating thing about the microbiome is that if you take any two people, there's a lot of similarity in the species in them and a lot of differences. And if you try to sort of slice humanity into different groups, we were talking about these sort of quote-unquote bug types, it's possible that they're kind of, you know, maybe some broad, distinct groups, but still there's lots of variations. And we don't really know the source of it. In this particular case, it was just the thinking was, well, you know, the fact is that you pick up a lot of the species you do pick up are just things that are in your environment. And this husband and this wife, obviously, they were very much in the same environment. So he would have a fairly similar microbiome. That was their, you know, sort of gut feeling, forgive the pun. There's no, like, really thorough science to back that up just because no one's done it yet. So they were just, it was kind of a seat of the pants thing. I mean, this woman was going to die. And so they were like, well, let's try this.
But it's interesting because it means possibly that you would necessarily, with blood types, you have to match blood types. With organ transplant, there are problems of rejection. With microbial transplants, that wouldn't necessarily be the case then, right?
Well, you know, not necessarily. But, you know, maybe we need, you know, when we do give people these probiotics I was just talking about, you know, when we say here, eat this special yogurt, it's got all these species we figured out you need. We might first need to test people's bug type to figure out what kind of yogurt they need to help get better.
Last question. I know you're not a tattoo guy, but if you were, what would it be?
If I were, what would it be? I'm thinking I'd probably go with the you know, your spouse's name in DNA. I mean, that's the first thing that kind of got me into all this, and I guess I am enough of a geek that I do find that quite romantic. So I would get Grace written in DNA, I think.
Carl Zimmer, the book Science Inc., Tattoos of the Science Obsessed. He'll be at UCSF, Mission Bay, Genentech, part of Byers Auditorium, in an hour and a half, talking about the microbial part of the story we discussed this morning. Later tonight, he'll be at Black and Blue Tattoo in San Francisco, and then after that, at Booksmith, the bookstore in the Haight-Ashbury District. Thanks for being with us today. Pleasure to have you on our program.
Thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. Our engineer today, Howard Gelman. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.